Hi, y'all. Welcome to the All Swell podcast, a student-led podcast in association with Coastal News Today and the Coastal Society. My name is Genevieve Gary, and I'm a PhD candidate at East Carolina University in the Integrated Coastal Sciences program.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast. I am Kira Hugge. I'm also getting my PhD in Integrated Coastal Sciences at ECU, and I'm really glad to have you.
Yeah, we really nailed down that beginning. And if you've been listening to our podcast recently, you may have heard us advertise about a Priority Issues in North Carolina event hosted by the Coastal Society at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And last week, we were fortunate enough to hold the event with help from multiple sponsors. And today on the podcast, we are going to summarize the forum and talk about the priority issues we discussed. We had three main topics for the day: natural and community resilience, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, also known as PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, and our last topic was marine spatial planning. We had a mix of speakers from academia, private industry, to community leaders and nonprofits who all shared their expertise in panel talks as well as in breakout groups, where participants could ask more detailed questions and it could be a group discussion on how maybe we can solve some of these issues. It was great to see so many stakeholders involved in discussions on coastal issues. We're going to begin the podcast to start with three discussion topics, and then we're going to talk about the main breakout sessions from those topics. So we'll start it off with a topic that's very close to Kira, which is natural and community resilience.
Yeah, so this topic is, I was very excited about having this at the event, at the forum, because my work ties into how, I'm working on how social capital or how people are connected to each other is impacting community resilience, or how well communities of people can withstand like these outside stressors, such as extreme weather events. So I was really excited to attend this panel discussion and also help with the breakout session before the lunch break.
Yeah, it was, this was really cool. And I think it was such a great way to start the day. And our first speaker was actually someone we've had on the podcast before. And if you go back and give a listen a little while back, it's Dr. Greer Arthur, and she is the research director of the North Carolina Co-Laboratory. And just a little reminder about the Co-Laboratory, if you're not in North Carolina or not familiar with it, but it was started by the North Carolina General Assembly in 2016 with goals of disseminating policy and research expertise across the North Carolina university system for practical use of state and local government. We'll talk about the collaboratory a little bit more in our next topic with PFAS, as they started a PFAS testing network. But Greer really came to show and highlight some of the stuff going on with community resilience that the collaboratory has helped fund. And one she really wanted to shine a light on was the collaboration between Elizabeth City State University and the Audubon Society to improve mapping of the coastline using drones. She talked about how if coastal planners have more access and accurate maps, they can better plan to protect and restore important coastal species such as marsh grasses, oysters, and other so-called green infrastructure. She mentioned that there were a lot of pitfalls in the beginning, especially since a lot of administrators are looking for clearly defined outcomes and deliverables. However, more often than not, there are other milestones that are more important, such as how the team collaborates and whether their efforts are sustainable into the future. There are needs for consistent funding over time and focus on collaboration beyond the initial project. I think Kira and I can agree that that's something, the consistent funding is something
that is nice. Yeah, very important.
You know, that's a close to the heart and soul of PhD communities. And I thought that was a really cool notion that she talked about, was looking at beyond these hard line metrics, and that we really needed to look at how collaborators were integrating with each other and how they were collaborating and actually building those relationships to go beyond the project itself. And she acknowledged that many administrators ask questions like why the project wasn't working or what needs to happen differently, instead of asking questions based on the relationship building, like potentially different goals and how to build better trust. One of her last remarks was mentioning the importance of having many different voices at the table for successful projects and building long-term relationships. We should start talking about co-designing research questions with communities with buy-in from the top to create projects that have purpose that lives on beyond the grant. I thought this was such a great way to start because it really stands for things that the Coastal Society is trying to do with integrating in across the different disciplines and then, you know, the different stakeholders such as academia, private industry, and the community members. So after we had Dr. Greer talk, we had Mackenzie Todd, who is from the Resilient Coastal Communities Program, also known as the RCCP. And just a little fun fact, Mackenzie is one of my master's classmates from the Masters of Coastal and Ocean Policy. It's a lot of words, program at UNCW. And so it was really cool to hear her talk about her work and how she's grown from when we were at UNCW to now. And so the RCCP was founded in 2016 from a predecessor. The current program began after Hurricane Florence, which happened in 2017. And Florence was 2018. Yeah. And focuses on risk and vulnerability assessments, community engagement, and identifying projects to mitigate vulnerabilities. So their program really objectives are to address, assist, help, advance, and to link together so many of the issues going on in kind of the coastal sphere. And to address this, they encourage leadership to meet communities where they are at, assist with developing vulnerability assessments, come up with a portfolio for potential projects, prioritize and advance projects, and link communities with other funding sources. And to do this, to meet these objectives, they divide the project into four phases. So they do community engagement, a vulnerability assessment, then they do a planning project identification, engineering planning, and implementation. And so she spent the rest of her talk really highlighting where these phases are at going in North Carolina and where the initiative is hoping to go. There are several communities throughout North Carolina that have applied for the partnership, and through various rounds, some of their infrastructure projects have been funded. Examples include stormwater and waste monitor management to shoreline protection. And many of these projects have nature-based or green solution, which is a priority for overall initiatives. So it's really cool to hear her talk about how the state is kind of addressing some of these problems at the community level.
Yeah, and as a follow-up, we had two more people. So that was a busy panel. I think we had two panels with four people and then one with three. So after Mackenzie and Dr. Greer Arthur, we had Ryan Davenport, and he was with Carter County, which is one of the coastal counties in North Carolina. It's kind of at the south end of the Outer Banks, kind of close-ish to where we actually were in Wilmington. And he formerly worked for the Division of Coastal Management, so he worked for the state. He talked about how Carter County and he as his position is in a beach management commission with a total of 11 members, which manages all of Bogue Banks. So that's like a pretty big area with like a regional sand management approach. So because they have this joint effort, they were able to manage the beach without sand wars. That's essentially when different towns bordering the same beach are using beach nourishment and then blame each other for getting their sand. Like they're putting it on their beach, but then it ends up on a different beach. And that's just, you know, because of the natural process that we call shoreline transport. I'm sorry, that's my baby daughter in the background. I hope you're okay with a little bit of life happening on this podcast. She was in Wilmington too, but not at the forum. Yeah, so he talked about how this committee of managers has also come up with like a 50-year permit and management plan, and they identified sand sources where they're at, and they set up some sort of a pre-permitting so that they would avoid these kind of wars and mismanagement between the different communities. And this Beach Management Commission has also done a 2-year survey of all of Onslow Bay for sand sources and are currently in phase two of identifying if these sands that they have found are compatible to the beaches where they should be put on to. Next, we had Todd Miller, and he is the founder and executive director of the North Carolina Coastal Federation, the Coastal Fed, that we have been talking about a few times in this podcast. Like, it's an organization that is very active in coastal North Carolina and has a lot of like funding too for doing research in this area. It is a nonprofit with over 60,000 supporters working generally to improve the health of the North Carolina coast. The current Coastal Fed goals are clean coastal waters and reduced coastal flooding. Also living shorelines, or like to promote living shorelines, abundant oysters, and an ocean that is free of marine debris. And we also had a podcast episode on marine debris, which was the one before the last one. So two podcast episodes ago. So if you want to, if you're interested in that, go look back on that episode and listen, give us a listen there. He described several advantages of living shorelines, with like the North Carolina General Assembly having started a cost share program for living shorelines, which has received a lot of political support. So people are actually getting benefits from implementing living shorelines, and also communities where the property is owned by the state or the municipality. Another important point that he mentioned were like habitat trade-off issues. So in North Carolina, we have a lot of salt marshes, but they have a hard time migrating inland due to like sea level rise, but then the coast is so built up that they can't really go anywhere. So the Coastal Fed is currently working on a salt marsh protection and conservation plan for the state, and has already assessed where marsh gain or loss will happen by 2050. So he showed us a bunch of different maps with like kind of heat maps with like green and red. And he showed where we would gain salt marsh and where we would lose. From what I was able to gather, we would gain salt marsh in areas where there's less population and lose it where there's a lot of population, like in the more southern areas, and then like gain some more in more towards like the Virginia border. He also shared that implementing living shorelines is a way of mitigating the loss of coastal protection. However, it's not a panacea. So what he said, and that's his own words, these things only buy us time. If we don't stop sea level rise, we can't cope with that on the coast. It's not a long-term solution. So that was a pretty important statement that he shared. And the Coastal Fed also has a wealth of resources for people to inform themselves about issues at the North Carolina coast, and which we will link in the show notes. So if you're interested in learning more about these different issues and the focal points of the Coastal Federation, you can go check those out.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the images that he shared. And like you said, it was really interesting because if you just looked at the statistics, it was like, oh, we're going to have salt marsh growth in, you know, by 2050. But really, we were losing so much salt marsh protection in areas that there is more infrastructure. And then where the salt marsh was going was into some agriculture land in the eastern area where Kira and I've also worked a lot. So, you know, when talking about trade-offs, it's like you can't just look at the statistical number. Even within states, you really have to look at the breakdown, like even beyond the county level of like where stuff is actually moving. And so now we're going to talk about what went on in the breakout sessions. And we wanted to use this as an opportunity so that if you were there at the conference and you didn't get to go to one because we had the natural and community resilience on at the same time as some of the PFAS. And now we're going to talk about that. So now you get the whole picture of what was talked about at the conference. And I will turn it back over to Kira because this is her expertise. And she was actually able to go into the natural and community resilience breakout sessions.
Yeah, was very well attended, and there was a lot of discussions. One point that so the way we structured it essentially was like these speakers were all in different breakout rooms, and then kind of were like faced the questions from the attendants, which was a super a format that worked really, really well for us, because it was more, you know, accessible than asking the speakers in the full plenary session where you like maybe don't like dare to ask a question. It's kind of like the whole, like when you're in school or if you ever attended the like college, like if you have to ask a question in the lecture, it's very daunting. But if you're like in the, like maybe the practice session or whatever, and then there's a TA, you know, and then it's like only 20 people, not 200. Yeah. So like, it's easier. Same with this. So people had brought up that, or had asked about like the community perception, and the speakers answered in a way that like community perceptions are very important, especially when it comes to shoreline protection or general measures to improve coastal resilience, because people have like different, you know, experiences depending on where they grew up and where they come from. And so for example, like, yeah, people having lived in the north, like up north on the east coast, even they don't really understand the benefit of having oyster beds for shoreline protection because they don't really have those. And so they just probably think, oh my god, this is like ugly, I don't like this, I don't want this. And so they would probably prefer bulkheads. However, the bulkheads are not habitat, so it's important to reach out to homeowners and ask them, what should your shoreline look like? What do you want your shoreline to look like? And there are opportunities to pair those hard shoreline protections like bulkheads with living shorelines such as oysters. So there's like this kind of what we also already kind of a little bit alluded to, this context, you know, like you have to really go into these communities and ask the people and really think about, okay, how can I get my objective across, but also take into account what people want. And then there was also a discussion about homeowners, like the home is, eventually will maybe change ownership. And then how is that going to affect, you know, the protection measure they have implemented? And so it's important to have kind of the sustainable knowledge in the population that they know, okay, you know, like, oysters are, maybe they don't look as pretty, you know, like as a bulkhead, but they're so much more beneficial. And so that's why we want to keep those in there. And there are different grants also up in Virginia who are looking at the gaps of implementation and how to make the transition from one homeowner to the next one kind of more seamless. There also, some of the participants noted that there are capacity issues in municipalities, which then also leads to gaps between state and municipal governments. Mackenzie Todd was asked how to keep engagement in those counties that didn't get funded. So remember, Genevieve has shared like that the project that she's working for, they essentially like they have like this huge call for applications essentially, and they want to build more resilient communities. And they don't have like infinite amount of money. They only have a certain amount. And so they have to like put it towards the things that and give it to the communities they think will benefit most from it, right? And is most sustainable. So she added to like that question that the communities are stretched thin, and then they only sometimes have one town clerk doing like 10 different jobs. And this person doesn't have the capacity to fill out applications and then also oversee the grant funds and also oversee the projects. So her initiative, the North Carolina Resilient Coastal Community Communities program is helping communities with the design, the planning, and redesign of the projects. So like those communities don't run into the issue that they haven't even started the implementation of the projects before the grant expires due to like lack of personnel. So they get the communities up until the point where they can actually do the things and help with those personnel issues, which I thought was very awesome of that initiative. And then Ryan Davenport, he has this managing position at Carter County. He added that his work, they're often looking for low or no maintenance projects. So these projects are more easily to sustain by these communities. And because they don't require money, right? And Dr. Arthur mentioned that in her work, it's extremely important to focus on the place and the context to be able to design the project, thinking about the capacities and how to support the people involved upfront. And then the last issue we discussed in this breakout group was the question about who gets to decide who is going to sit at a table, which I thought was a very, very interesting question. For the inclusion of different voices in resilience planning, Mackenzie Todd added that for her projects, they usually find, like she called it, the community champion, which is like an individual who has the trust of the whole community. And this person can then help identify the people who should sit at the table. I also thought that was a pretty good approach to like have the inclusion.
Yeah, I love that. And I think it goes great into our next subject, which is PFAS. And we're going to highlight a couple community champions in that realm. And just, I think, again, that I think capacity is such a big word that's getting talked about now. And, you know, do communities have the capacity to build up resilience to some of these issues? And in some cases, it's compounding issues. It's not just sea level rise or the loss of the marsh protection. We've seen with some of our classmates, it's the, you know, saltwater intrusion, or do they even have the capacity, as we'll talk later, to have wind farms with offshore wind? And so this is just a great way to kind of start where we're going to today. And now we're going to shift gears a little bit more onto emerging contaminants, forever chemicals. And this is my area of expertise. And so, you know, to talk about environmental issues in North Carolina and Wilmington specifically at this point is to talk about these chemicals. It may be one of the most talked about things in our state at this point. And some days it feels as though like Wilmington, the town, is kind of at the front line of the PFAS problem. And maybe for some solutions as well, and or it can at least talk do's and don'ts of the whole issue. For those of you that are not familiar, I'm going to give a very brief background into why Wilmington is kind of at the front lines for this. So in 2017, Vaughn Haggerty, who's a local news reporter, broke the news to the residents that there was some chemical that was called its nickname as Gen X that was in the water in Wilmington. And it was in the finished drinking water in the Wilmington area through the public utility, which does service the most of the people in the Wilmington and surrounding area. And so ever since then, North Carolina has pretty much consistently been in the local, regional, and even sometimes global news about PFAS, because its citizens in Wilmington have really been fighting back about these chemicals. They came from a manufacturing plant upriver, more closer to Fayetteville, North Carolina. It's known as Fayetteville Works. It was originally built by DuPont back in the 80s, which is originally when they think these chemicals started dumping into the air, water, and bio matter kind of around the area. And it really wasn't until this really wasn't local knowledge until 2017. And so we ended up having five panelists that really ranged for this topic. And the first one was actually a program coordinator for the PFAS network that we just mentioned earlier that came out of the co-laboratory. So we had overlapping stakeholders for this issue.
Yeah. The first speaker was Rochelle Hart. And again, yeah, she is the coordinator for the UNC WCMS program, and she works on program coordination, and works with the project director. So kind of she's like the below person. I forgot what that I'm lacking words, but it's she's working under UNCW's Dr. Ralph Mead, and their team consists of 20 researchers across multiple universities that are divided into four groups, which is air, water, toxicology, and applied research. The PFAS network uses the funding they get to make like PFAS or the knowledge about PFAS kind of more salient and more understood by being the point of contact for research and information. They facilitate data and access to data and the research for like technologies that could then potentially hopefully remove PFAS, as well as they run a website with access to their data hub. The website name is ncpfasnetwork.com, and we're also going to link that in the show notes so that you can go check that out if you are interested in learning more what the network is doing. And then the next speaker was actually just transferred to our own university that like where Gigi and I are getting our PhDs. It was Dr. Pingping Meng, and she's assistant professor at the ECU Department of Chemistry. Her talk was named Tackling PFAS is Treating the Water Enough. In this talk, she like kind of presented her research that is currently looking at PFAS in food that is locally grown around the areas that have wells that were contaminated with PFAS near that Chemours plant that Gigi has talked about. And their group was able to collect 54 samples from 5 different houses, and they found like 10 PFAS, including 8 PFEAS. And Gigi can tell us the difference. I do not know and do not remember.
Those are per- and polyfluorinated ethyl alcohols.
Okay. Great. Yeah. So it's another different category of these really lovely things that never break down. And so at least it 10% of the produce samples, they detected PFAS in the tissue of the things. So they actually sampled like, and that I thought that was crazy. They sampled like blackberries and blueberries and pickled cucumbers and all these things. And they found PFAS in all of them, essentially, or like one or more of them, which is crazy. And some of them were, like very, very high concentration. And it's currently really unclear if there is she also showed that there's some sort of a decline over the couple of survey years that they had. I think I had about like 4 or 5 years consecutively. And they showed some sort of a decline in the plant uptake, but it's not really clear if that's just happening in that particular area or like if that's really somehow going down. We don't really know what's happening there. So that needs more research. There might be a correlation between the PFAS in produce and groundwater. But again, no clue whether that's actually happening. However, it's crazy because we don't usually, or historically, we've only looked at PFAS in water and like how, you know, tested wells, tested maybe surface water. I think some groundwater as well, but like not really anything that was kind of in touch with the soil and the water. So to me, that was very unnerving to know that PFAS are also in the food that we're eating. So we're not only exposed by the air and by the water, but we're also exposed by the food that we're eating, which is just lovely.
Yeah, the food itself, because originally it was like, okay, if it came in touch with like a Teflon pan or the wrapping that's in fast food, it was never like the food item itself. And as Pingping mentioned, she's like, you cannot wash this off. Like it's in the blueberry. It's not on top the blueberry like you would think of like other pesticides or herbicides. It's in the blueberry itself. And she really showed too what it would be like, okay, if you drink this amount of water, what's the equivalent of blueberries for that? So it's like, you could end up having a handful of blueberries that were heavily contaminated And that's your PFAS intake for the day, which was really crazy. Okay, and after Dr. Ping Ping Ming, we had Riley Lewis, who is the White Oak Waterkeeper with the Coastal Carolina River Watch. Another fun fact is Riley and I are double classmates. We represent the University of South Carolina Gamecocks and the University of Wilmington Seahawks. So it's really great to see Riley again. And she really talked about the water quality in the Lower Outer Banks area. And she talked about working with community needs and engagements in regard to water quality. A lot of coastal communities are not familiar with the PFAS issue. And as we kind of mentioned earlier, they're kind of everywhere. They are migrating. They stick around a long time, and they can have potential harmful effects for your body as well. And so they researched the PFAS in surface waters within the U.S. and found that about 86% had detectable levels of PFAS. Now, no detectable levels were in the headwaters of the White Oak, but there were some issues with well waters in which they were thought that those were coming from firefighting foams. And so firefighting foams have a chemical known as AFFF in it. Or that's the term you'll hear them call is AFFF. They have a PFAS cousin pretty much in them that can stay in the environment over a really long time. And they found that one of the highest concentrations was near an airfield. And so that's pretty common given the fact that they have that foam ready to go in case you have any fires. And so they also found that PFOAs, another nickname for a class within the whole PFAS group, were persistent in waterways. And so they were working with the community and providing outreach materials to kind of inform and let people know what is going on with these chemicals right now. The military is definitely moving away from AFFF, but an area that was interesting, and I had never heard of this, I've been working on PFAS for a long time, is that marinas have it because it's in their fire suppression systems, especially for those big dry stacks, which if you're not familiar, that is when they put pretty much the boats on like a giant shelf and they are stacked upon one another. And so that is what her organization has really been doing. And they've ended up working with Duke University too, to look at PFAS and mercury and other heavy metals that are in oysters around these marinas to kind of identify the level of a contaminant and then identify the sources. And in this case, they identified the dry stack marines. And in one case, they were actually able to get the marina to get rid of that fire suppression system and put in a new one that didn't have that AFFF. So that was a really cool example of working with the community, doing outreach and going and talking to some of these places that weren't traditionally thought of as sources for pollution. And going along with the Riverkeeper thing, after Riley, we had Dana Sargent, who is the executive director of the Cape Fear River Watch. And she has been the executive director since early 2019. And so Cape Fear River Watch was actually one of the nonprofits that sued Chemours, which is now requiring a consent order in which Chemours is supposed to be providing people around them clean water, which that could be bottled water, that can be in-house filtration systems. And then they are supposed to remediate and start taking some of the PFAS that they've put in out into the environment. As well as look at solutions, meaning that there is, you know, supposed to be no Gen X, the main chemical that they were producing, coming out. However, the consent order led them to capturing the PFAS and shipping their waste offsite to Texas to a deep well in Jackson. So we did not really solve the problem. We just moved the problem somewhere else. And that is why Dana is so great, because she talks about this kind of never ending cycle. It goes from one community to the next and impacts them. And so they also looked at kind of, they did a non-target analysis, shows that there's about 257 unknown PFAS. And then they found another 100 known PFAS. So really the problem is that they'll get them to, you know, say, hey, we're going to stop with Gen X. One out of thousands of PFAS that can be present in pretty much, as you just, you know, heard Kira talk about with the agriculture, the groundwater, the air. We know that it's also in the sea foam. It's in pine needles. Anywhere you look for PFAS, you're going to find it. And so they have also, the Cape Fear River Watch has sued the EPA. And they are doing this because they are trying to get health studies done. Other states have required health studies. North Carolina hasn't. There is some health studies going on right now through NC State and the PFAS testing network to look at residents that are kind of south of the Fayetteville work site towards Wilmington. But the funding through the Department of Environmental Quality in North Carolina seems to be keep getting slashed. And with no legislation passed, there's not as much research coming in. I can speak from like personal experience from this. I am doing PFAS research, but my own institution is funding it, not North Carolina, not, you know, money coming from Chemours to help fund and look at the problem. And Dana really, really talks about how they have tried to work with policy and try and work with politicians and try and get PFAS kind of regulated at the state level. And they've really been upset because Chemours has said, oh, well, we need to make more Gen X because it's helpful with the green economy. And so really kind of they have pushed back so much on what Chemours has done. And, you know, they're in a nonprofit, so they can't directly tell us who to vote for. But our next speaker, another community champion, was Emily Donovan. And she is the co-founder of Clean Cape Fear, which is a volunteer-run grassroots community group. So with being for-profit, they can endorse and then make publicly available which politicians are pretty much going to help with the PFAS problem and which politicians aren't. And Clean Cape Fear was responsible for getting schools clean water through adding reverse osmosis filtration systems in schools. Reverse osmosis pretty much takes everything out of the water except for the elements itself. And so this was really important because students and children are a very vulnerable group and have been. If you've grown up in Wilmington since the 80s, then you are more likely to have more of these different concentrations of PFAS in your blood. And so Emily has worked really hard to make sure that people can still get clean water. And an item missing a lot of times is that people have been self-paying for water treatments, or they've also been buying bottled water. And so Clean Cape Fear has worked really hard to get contaminators to pay for their cleanup so that when we're talking about equity, we're really talking about that the polluter pays and that the burden is not on the ratepayer to pretty much be contaminated with these issues. They've also been really vocal that it's in our coastline, that it's in the seafoam, and that when you have the PFAS, when you have wave energy, those PFAS that were in the foam, that are in the water, they get aerosolized and then they move something else. And she's also really highlighted that we're still waiting on fish advisories. We don't know if the blue crabs that are harvested in our area that are getting sent off to Maryland have high concentration of PFAS. So that really goes back to what we talked about earlier with the kind of digestive part of this issue. And they've also talked about how cancer is understudied and they don't have access, like I said earlier, to medical monitoring. So Clean Cape Fear has really been working with other communities to help get the health guidelines, get the health advisories with the EPA. And they have gone to DC to have the EPA write that PFAS are hazardous chemicals. And so it was really great to have two huge champions of PFAS at this panel and listen to them talk. I wish I could, we could probably dedicate a whole podcast to what they've been doing. And we're so thankful for them for coming for the day, especially in Wilmington. And so really the theme that then went into our breakout sessions on PFAS was the policy. If you'd like to know more about what PFAS does in the body, where it is in the environment, please feel free to reach out to me or one of our speakers. However, when we were doing the breakout sessions, we were really focusing on the policy. So one of the questions was, so what is going on at the federal level? What's going on at the state level? And even, you know, we talked a little bit about what's going on internationally too. And so there, as of right now, there is no pretty much enforceable level for regulation for these chemicals. And there are some health advisories that the EPA has set, but over time they have made those little, they have made it less and less and less. So at first when they had the original data, they're like, oh, you can have this amount. And now as the years have gone by, more research has come out. They've said, oh, you can have even less. You can have even less. There has actually been clinical guidelines now, but you, for you to know, you'd have to pay yourself to get your blood tested. And then you would probably have to inform your doctor, unless they are some of the few and amazing ones that have been to the PFAS conferences. You'd have to inform them, hey, this is what these new national clinical guidelines say. Hey, you need to check for this cancer, this thyroid issue, immune system, and everything else. So really, we haven't had health standards that are really efficient and they're non-numerical. So then it makes it difficult to enforce the people that then let the PFAS into the water. One of the big things that was brought up is that within the state itself, the Department of Environmental Quality is underfunded and they're unable to enforce standards, even if there were standards. And so a lot of times funding is right now, it's going towards reactive measures, aka filtration and trying to just get the PFAS out instead of going into proactive ones, which would include, you know, discontinuing production. Many times the funding that is available is only available for 5 out of the thousands of PFAS. So while they're looking for 5, they're missing the concentrations of all of the rest of those. And so they'd really like to see what we kind of came out of this breakout session is that they would really like the clinical guidelines to be adopted. But this will then impact insurance companies, especially Medicaid. So this economically is going to have a huge problem. Myself, one of my advisors, and another advisor who is now at Oregon State, we have all been talking and about how they have to be regulated as a class of chemicals and not just one. And an issue with that is that then you get into discussions about actually defining PFAS. So how many carbons is it? How many fluorines is it? And we've already seen people kind of, you know, fighting back and forth with that. Do we need PFAS for these green solutions? Just to give an idea, I won't go too much more longer on this subject. Chemours itself, so this is one company out of, you know, a couple that make these chemicals. Last year, they had $1.2 billion in revenue. And it recently came out last week that they spent between Chemours, DuPont, 3M, Honeywell, they spent $110 million last year trying to stop legislation from going through for PFAS bills across North Carolina and across the rest of the country. I think that $110 million could be much more spent on research and helping pay for these large scale health studies that are really needed in the community. And so a couple days, I'll just finish on this. After a couple days after Dr. Biddle, who is also, she's a UNCW professor, and she was on our TCS planning committee for this event, we went to Atlanta to discuss the policy implications further at the Association of Public Policy Analysis and Management annual conference, also known as APAM. And long story short, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Water Drinking Act, the Superfund Act, there is law right now as it's written in the United States that could help enforce these chemicals. It's just not happening. And it would be economically cheaper to pretty much turn off the tap than having to clean up the bathtub that just keeps overfilling of these PFAS issues. So thank you all for listening to that.
That just sounded like, I don't know, overly familiar in terms of like all the, like every environmental issue, like starting with like CO2 and like all these other pollutants, like it ends up being the same thing, right? Like,
yeah,
we should not produce them in the first place. And once we know we should not, we should stop. And like, yeah, we're not doing it. So we're getting into all these stupid issues. And now we're here, you know?
Yeah, I think that could be a podcast we could definitely do in the future, is how green are some of these green energies that are getting pushed policy-wise. Yeah.
Actually, we're going to, a good segue to the next session, because we were also talking about marine spatial planning. And that was like after the lunch break, and we had another like three really awesome panelists. And marine spatial planning essentially is kind of concerned about like the different uses of the marine space. So like all these different stakeholders, and that also includes the plants and animals that live in the ocean, like have different requirements. They want to use the ocean for different things. And so if we are making an example, is like marine dredging for like sand that we just talked about as well, that can be used for beach renourishment. Like fishers have different different opinions of how this area should be used. And they don't want dredging because it clouds the water, because it like they can't fish because the fish are going somewhere else, and the fish can live there right now, like right in the moment where it's dredged. But dredging operators obviously want to dredge in that spot because that's where they identify the best sand is at. And then the coastal communities have like different ideas of like how this all should work and where dredging should be happening and where it shouldn't. So like marine spatial planning is essentially that. And another salient topic, which like is related to those like so-called renewable or green energies, is offshore wind energy. And the first panel speaker, Gigi, is going to talk about her. She was with the Southeast Wind Coalition.
Yeah, so first we had Carly Lohan, another MCOP graduate from our program. So that puts us at like, what, four of us that were there for the day at least, as well as we had a lot of current students as well. And so it was actually really cool to talk to her after, to hear her transition from going from academia into working for an organization like this. So the Southeast Wind Coalition is a 501c3 organization, aka nonprofit, whose members are offshore developers, utilities, academic groups, etc. What they do is they broker between different interest groups to promote the development of offshore wind farms. And so there are currently 11 states who are thinking about or already have integrated in offshore wind energy generation into their energy mix. In North Carolina right now, three leases are in the planning phase. So one off of Kitty Hawk through Avangrid Renewables, and then two leases in the Carolina Long Bay. One is a lease unregulated owned by Duke Energy, and the other is from Total Energy. So Kitty Hawk, that one is really close to the Virginia border. And then the other one, Carolina Long Bay, is when you look at the map of Carolina, it's that kind of last C on the coast. So more closer to the port of Wilmington and so forth. And so her work is helping towards fulfilling that carbon reduction plan that has been proposed by the North Carolina Utilities Commission, which has been tasked by Duke Energy to come up with a plan to be carbon neutral by 2050. And every 2 years, there is an evaluation of the carbon plan proposal, which is incorporated into the final plan after it has been approved by the Utilities Commission. The offshore wind leases off the coast that are in different stages of development, with the Kitty Hawk North being the furthest along, aiming to start production of energy early next year in 2024. Wow, that seems really close, but really cool and really close to me. And I'm going to be very intrigued where that energy comes ashore, because that has been one of the biggest discussions, is a lot of these, where they can do these where they have the most wind to get the energy efficiently, where is it going to come on shore? Because a lot of those areas are not that built up. And so, yeah, we'll turn it off to Kier to talk about our next panelists from this session.
Yeah. And actually, we have talked about in the breakout groups or the breakout rooms, we have talked about that kind of like, what does make a most sense in terms of like how much line do we need to get the energy onshore and all this stuff. But first, we had Daniel Giovanni. He is with he is the Federal Consistency Coordinator at the North Carolina Division of Coastal Management. And because he is with the state, he underlined the importance of the so-called federal consistencies, which is essentially a provision in the Coastal Zone Management Act that requires the federal government to comply with a state's coastal management program when they take actions that are likely to affect coastal resources. Such an instance is also the development of offshore wind, for example, where the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy, or the BOEM, who has a jurisdiction beginning like 3 miles from shore and seaward, and the state of North Carolina are working together to ensure the coastal resources are protected. He highlighted the North Carolina Coastal Area Management Act, or CAMA, of 1974, which regulates the land use planning and development in coastal areas. So essentially kind of that plan has precedence over any federal things. So like, because the state, the coastal areas should be protected for that state. And so the federal kind of legislations have to work in conjunction with the state ones. So within CAMA, there are different permits and authorizations, like minor permits that are established by local governments for like, if you want to establish or like have a deck at your house or a walkover or something. Then there are general permits that are issued by different people. And then there are major permits for like marinas and beach renourishment. So depending on how much impact you have on the coastline, essentially, you get a different form of permit. And then all federal actions have to be found consistent with the enforceable policies of the state's approved program. It was very interesting to have like all these different people from these different organizations, because we had Carly from like a nonprofit, then we had Daniel from the state, and then last we had Dr. Martin Poisey, who is a professor. So like we had the academia research side as well. He's a professor of biology at UNCW, and his talk was titled "Ecosystem Analysis of Frying Pan Shoals." So frying pan shoals, so we're tossing a bunch of different geographical names around. That is essentially the shoals off of Cape Fear, also kind of close to that Wilmington area, and has been identified as a source of sand. So now we're back to the beach renourishment part. This area is like about 28 miles long and 35 to 50 feet deep. And there's only one cut-through channel that is also shifting because it's sand. Nothing stays ever in the same place. And that has been responsible for a lot of shipwrecks. So that's kind of like the historical importance of frying pan shoals. The shoal also leads to an extended pattern for the different species that live there. So now we talk about, you know, the biotic response. And so a lot of these little critters are using the shoals, but so it's important also then for the blue crab fishery, the shrimp fishery, and other commercial fisheries of other offshore fishes. And then on top of these fish, we also have protected species that are like migratory birds and whales, and they all use this unique habitat. Then we have the major port in Wilmington that is important for shipping and needs dredging of these things. So like we have all these, so marine spatial planning, essentially, right? We have all these uses together and all collide in this one particular space.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really cool example too. And then Dr. Poisey mentioned that the demand for sand is only going to increase because we have sea level rise, which—
Oh yeah.
Yeah, less beaches, but we need beaches because we want to go to the beach, right?
And tourism. I mean, exactly. You know, money signs right now. You think about
making
Wilmington.
Money. Ka-ching. And yep. so, and all these beaches around, they undergo periodic beach renourishment, and then there's a huge deficit even within the next 50 years, which is not that long, to be honest. Sounds long for right now, but we're almost in like 2025, and like that sounded far in a couple of years ago. Anyways, in his work, Dr. Poisey and his team are examining if the shoal can be used as a source for sand. And the early stages of the research project are looking at physical, geological, and biotic characteristics, oceanographic conditions, and then the flow of transport of that sand. They also look at the like benthic communities, which are like the critters that live on or in the sand. And the team is working on computer models to understand the sand transport and movement along the shore to guide the dredging efforts to places where kind of the disturbance is minimal. And yeah, I can also like briefly just like talk about the breakout sessions. We mainly discussed wind energy and how these projects are so difficult to implement, because also which not only, you know, the bringing to shore, bringing the energy to shore is a problem, but also constructing these huge turbines, because they're like huge and can't be like just kind of like hauled across the US. So they need to be constructed in the place where they are being put in. So essentially you have to like come up with a whole construction facility at the spot, like the land spot or the shore spot of like the offshore location. So that's very interesting. Then there are like different state agencies that are working on establishing blueprints for the compensation. So if fishers are getting like losses because they can't fish the area where the offshore wind park is being developed, they get compensation from the state, but then how much should they get and how is this all being calculated is all not. So there's not really like, this is how you do it, you know? So they're working on that. There are also a lot of challenges with like, okay, so now you have these wind turbines in the ocean, kind of anchored to the floor. You can have some artificial reefs on them, would be nice, right? And it works, but then that also attracts like marine mammals, like whales, and they could be confused by the vibration that these like wind turbines put out. And so you have like so many different like colliding interests there that like people have to kind of like work through. And that's why it's so difficult to get these offshore wind efforts off the ground, essentially. And then in the European Union, they have like, over in Europe, we have a little bit more of offshore wind already in use, and also kind of like a more integrated approach between the countries. And so the panelists were remarking that the US should have like a similar pathway so that the different projects are sharing like data and insights and best management practices so that they don't have to develop everything from scratch again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
That sounds like, no, it sounds like pretty much just like every issue, right? Like I agree. Like it's the same with the PFAS. Like we need to be sharing insight across states, like how, you know, Emily and Dana really highlighted that North Carolina doesn't have any legislation that's passed. So how did some of these other states get it passed? And that's what we really need, is kind of like a network to collaborate and integrate and look at, like you just said, like the insights to all these approaches. And I think that was just a theme that kind of ran across all three topics that we had for the day. And I just got to say, I really enjoyed like working with the planning team on this over the last couple months. It was really fun to work with new and unfamiliar faces and finally have an event in person. It was so nice to see somebody who you've seen on Zoom so many times, to be there in person with them. And, you know, Wilmington is just always going to have a special place in my heart. And it was so cool. And to see so many people from my master's program there. And then those that had, as I mentioned earlier, that have kind of moved on to all these different fields. It really shows like how far you can go when you're doing more interdisciplinary science.
Yeah. And for me also, like, I kind of want to echo that with the like amazing organizing committee that we were part of. I really enjoyed like seeing everything kind of come together and like how hard everyone worked and to like carry out this very successful event. And I engaged in so many conversations with people from like different backgrounds and to work for like all these like interesting organizations that some of them I've heard of, but like others I haven't. And like, I just was like amazed about, you know, the breadth of this, like of the people that like this organization, which is the Coastal Society, kind of like has, you know, like, or has access to. So we were able to bring people together to share their work and to integrate and form new connections, which then helps them, you know, to serve their communities, their constituents better and improve the research. So we can actually really meet the goals of like protecting the coast and everything that we value in it.
Yeah. And just thank you to all who participated in our event, to the sponsors, to our planning team, and to our listeners that have followed all the way through with this podcast. We'd love to know if you'd like more of kind of these event breakdowns. You know, if maybe Kira and I or one of our other like followers, they'll go to a conference if you want to hear more from that specific one, because, you know, there's never enough money to go around. Kira and I were just talking about this podcast. We'd love to go to more to have these interactions, but you need money to go to them. And if you'd like more information, head over to our website, and especially head over to the Coastal Society, because we will have a lot of the notes of everything that we just said up there. And also feel free to reach out to Kira or I, and we can put you in contact with the speakers if you're interested in hearing more about their work. And with that, we will finish off. Where there's a will, there's a wave.